Everybody, Stephen Cloud here, back for another episode. I'm really excited about this one because I've been involved with cryptocurrency since about February 2017 myself. My guest today is, his name is R.L. Breyer. He's been in crypto since 2011. He just came out with a new ebook. It's called Blockchain Project Renaissance. Thanks for coming on, R.L.
I appreciate it. Thanks for having me as your guest today.
Absolutely. I mean, tell us a little about yourself before we dive into the book.
Yeah, I grew up close to Youngstown, Ohio, not too far from Pittsburgh, and went to school at Ohio State, started learning about blockchain in like 2010. I heard it, I think, you know, I heard about Bitcoin. And then at around 2011, 2012, I started getting pretty immersed in it and started looking at Litecoin specifically myself. And then just over the last 7-8 years now, I guess I've just delved pretty deep into it and wanted to write a book about it.
So what is your book about and why did you write it?
It's targeted towards helping people understand the importance of decentralization and how we're going to be able to use dApps, as we kind of touched on here briefly, decentralized applications to, I think, increase the breadth of production. In the economy, in all economies.
Awesome. And I guess I'll just preface by saying that a lot of the stuff we're going to be talking about this episode, I already know myself. I've been involved with crypto for a while. So this episode's really for the beginner in crypto. Well, I guess we'll talk about all the stuff. But let's jump into the first topic you jump into the book. It's called Commodity Money versus Fiat. Now, this is the one area where I think there's a little bit of a debate going on here, because when I was first getting involved in crypto, you know, there's a big question of is Bitcoin fiat money? Is it a commodity money? What is it? So just to define what a commodity money is, gold's always traditionally been a commodity money, meaning that it's been used. You can use gold for stuff. It's used as a commodity. And eventually what Murray Rothbard, other Austrian economists, would argue is that money comes from a commodity. Any true money comes from a commodity. So the debate about whether Bitcoin's a commodity has to do with, is there features of Bitcoin that relate to an actual physical commodity? So maybe I'll just let you start this off. This is like everything else is totally standard, but this is the one area where I personally always thought that it does seem plausible that Bitcoin's a commodity for the reasons that you use electricity to mine it. There is inputs, no doubt, that go into making it. So what's your view on that?
That's exactly how I look at it. The inputs of the electricity and just the overall, I mean, the mining process, there's a lot involved in that, you know. It's sort of just like the, right, you know, old school mining, any other sort, you know, there's some sort of means being put in, like you said, the inputs into giving it some sort of value. I know a lot of people still don't really understand that it could have, you know, this digital scarcity, but I just think the more that you delve into it, you really understand how scarce it is, and that it really does have the intangibles, or the same exact qualities as gold, but honestly better, in my opinion. So
I guess what people probably get caught up on is that Bitcoin, in its essence, is binary code. It's computer manufactured binary code. I guess one of the real reasons it has value is because of blockchain, and that people want to use a system without a third party involved. And that's exactly the point, is that Bitcoin as an example of a coin, it has built-in protocols to attack the system. You need like 51% attacks, which is, you know, nearly impossible. There have been coins that have faced 51% attacks, but I don't think they've been any of the big coins.
Yeah, we haven't seen it. We haven't seen anything close to taking down Bitcoin, I don't think, in the, what is it now, 9 years? 9 years since Bitcoin has been launched. So I don't see that. I don't foresee that. I think that the way that Satoshi, you know, built the protocol up and all that, I think I don't think it's plausible. Even if they did fool the network, it would only last for a minute or something. So I'm told, you know, I'm taking that from somebody else who knows more about than me. But I just don't think it's plausible to shut it down. I think we would have seen it a long time ago.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Well, let's jump right into it. So I'm going to quote Paul Krugman here. He said, I think it was in 1998 he said this. He said, the growth of the internet will slow drastically as the flaw in Metcalfe's law becomes apparent. By 2005 or so, it will become clear that the internet's impact on the economy has been no greater than the fax machines. So the reason I bring that up is because you go through Metcalfe's Law and Moore's Law. So can you tell us about both of those?
Yeah, those are two laws that basically show that the there's going to be a major expedition in any technology that you go by the root of the people in the network. So as more people get in, it you know, the web, just you can just see the web. I talk about my earliest days in Facebook. I was one of the first people on the Facebook network. And I can already see that in some of the blockchains, like Steam in particular. It's a social media platform, decentralized blockchain, just like it operates as a sort of Facebook, but on a blockchain where the individuals are reaping the benefits. I can see these sort of effects taking place already. And it just seems to me that it won't slow down. This is Internet 3.0 or whatever you want to call it. You know, this is going to be like the next layer to the Internet or whatever. This is going to be, I think it's already emerging as maybe equally as important.
Now, what is Moore's Law?
Moore's Law is more on a computer science level, where you're talking about numbers of circuits speeding up things like cell phones and stuff. And this is going to be, it's the same idea, but put it on, we're talking about dApps on a cell phone and stuff, you know.
I guess what we're talking about, what we're talking about overall is just rate of adoption.
Yes, exactly. That's what I was trying to get to.
All right. Well, there we go. Well, it all started with Satoshi Nakamoto. For people that don't know what the Genesis block is, basically it was the first ever block as part of the Bitcoin blockchain. And inscribed in the Genesis block, Satoshi noted this: "The Times, January 3rd, 2009, Chancellor on brink of second bailout for banks." So you get the idea that, I don't know if Satoshi was an Austrian economist or what, but he knew what was going on with the bank bailouts and the financial recession. So yeah, tell us about the Genesis block.
Yeah, I think when he wrote that, he had some major insight to what was going to happen there. So he wrote that into the beginning of the code and stuff, that, you know, about Banksy, and he embedded the Times of London. It's apparent he was reading Rothbard as well.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm pretty sure he was, because I think he or the group of individuals, or she, I guess, had a major, they conceptualized economics. You know, they brought everything together, and it's just amazing what they were able to do to me. To have the foresight to basically release it like right after the bailout that's just amazing, you know.
Seems a little bit intentional, but
yeah.
Another thing worth the viewers would like to know is that Satoshi apparently mined like the first about 2 million bitcoins, and I think about a million of those have never been spent. So when you talk about there's only 21 million Bitcoins in total, a lot of them are already locked away. I was reading this one article weeks ago about, I forget how many Bitcoins it was, maybe like a million, that all the keys are like scattered across continents now, and it's like buried. Like there's millions of Bitcoins that are out of the market, meaning any Bitcoins that are left will have more value in the end, because obviously money that you can't access to, it's just reducing the supply that's actually available.
Yeah, I actually have first-hand experience with this exact scenario. This happened to me, something similar to that. When I got in 2012, this is one of the things I wanted to write the book about, started, you know, putting coins on my hard drive. That's when like everyone ran a full node, no matter what blockchain you were on. There was only a few back then, you know, Litecoin, Bitcoin, and, you know, a handful. But anyways, I lost all my coins because my computer failed. So that was like another example of that, where opposed to, you know, state fiat, as I talk about in the book, we were talking about commodity money versus, you know, paper. The quantitative easing over time, the amount of scarcity obviously is nothing now, you know. When you go into digital, you're talking about Bitcoin, where I have lost my keys. I'm just wondering how many keys over the course of the time are going to be just, you know, into the ether, for lack of a better term.
I imagine the best estimate is just looking at coins that have never been spent. Like, okay, these coins have never been spent, you know, since like 2009. Probably lost. probably lost, but it's really hard to say. I imagine Satoshi has plenty that is, you know, right at his grasp. But I wanted to
say one more thing on that, if I can. I don't know if Satoshi's still around or not. I personally think Satoshi was the one guy that passed away. I'm blanking on his name right now, but I don't even know if Satoshi's around. So that does put us in sort of a weird position. Like, does his kid or whoever have these keys? It could be anybody who has the keys, you know.
And I think we're assuming it's one guy. I mean, say it wasn't a team of people that set this all up. It would seem actually implausible that it was one guy that got out and did this, but it's so hard to say. It's just one of those, you know, burning questions.
Yeah.
Well, you know, let's jump right into Bitcoin and actually how it works, because we just could be kind of prefacing so far. How does Bitcoin work? Tell us about private keys, public keys, wallets, and mining.
All right, so where should we start? With your private keys, I guess. Private keys are the keys that you shouldn't – you don't own your private keys if you leave your private keys on an exchange. That's how I always like to start it, because that's a major misconception a lot of individuals have coming into Bitcoin, that if you – purchase coins or tokens on an exchange that you own the keys and you don't own the keys. So you need to differentiate between your private and public keys and figure out a good means to store them, whether it's a paper wallet, which most people really don't delve into.
Just to interject real quick, I would imagine that a lot of the reason exchanges hold your private keys, I don't know if this is the main reason, but imagine like your account gets banned. They can still have access to all your coins that they've essentially stole from you because they have your private keys. I don't know if that's the main reason. I can just imagine that if you get banned, they have your coins.
Yeah, they definitely have your coins. That's interesting. I haven't thought too much about the exchanges like just ripping people off like that. But I would, if you're going to leave your keys on one of the exchanges, which I highly don't recommend that, pick one of the top two or three maybe, you know.
I was banned from like maybe one exchange. I think it was like Nova Exchange. I don't know if there were some random laws passed overnight where like it was legal in the US. That happens sometimes. I'm banned from my one account and I had a few $100 in there. So they have it now.
Make sure that's the second part of that, was to get yourself a hardware wallet or some sort of device to hold them on, or really do your due diligence and make yourself a paper wallet.
Yeah.
Which is you go somewhere and you generate the key and you export it basically to a piece of paper.
Exactly. I think one good analogy is if you think about the US Post Office or just any mailman, they go to the mailbox key, a box, and they open it with their private key. They take out the letters. So essentially, once you put a letter in the mailbox, you can't take it back out. You need the private key to unlock that mailbox, and then the mailman takes all the mail and sends it out. So that's kind of one of the analogies, that the private key is what you hold personally, which allows you to actually access the coins, and your public key, I mean, that's pretty much just an address.
Yeah, that's just where you say, like, for example, I'm selling my book right now. I'm putting my public key out there, and people can use that public key, and, you know, that's how you can send the money to another recipient.
Yep. Well, you have one section of your book titled "The Renaissance Will Not Be Centralized." Tell me about that.
Yeah, I'm also a big Austrian. That's really how I got my start in learning and being basically obsessed with currency and economics.
You see my two books behind me, my team.
Yeah, my hero back there, Murray Rothbard. So hey. He literally is my hero. I've got Four New Liberty right here myself. I think we're at a pivotal juncture. That's how I started the book. And I just think that we have a major choice in front of us here between even within blockchains. You know, we have a major choice outside of them, which is centralization versus decentralization. But inside that blockchain paradigm, there's also the same binary. And if we choose the wrong one here, I think we could be in for a lot of trouble. So I tried to break down why I think we need to use decentralized blockchains to educate people and just, you know, encourage a more prosperous world.
And another point you point out a little later in the book is that people want sound currency. You know, not everybody's an economic genius. Obviously, that's a start. But, you know, most people understand that they want to have a better life. They want to be able to get by. They want to know that it's crazy to think that in 1913, if you had $100 saved, that'd be worth like a dollar now, dollar, $2 now, because it's lost like 98% of its value. So that's theft. And what you talk about in the book is that the way crypto is set up, I mean, obviously the price fluctuates right now, but long term, it's inflated upward because of the supply restrictions, more people getting in on it. It's not a deflationary type of system. It obviously just goes up and up.
Even if we see a million or a trillion people a year getting in, which I think will exceed that over the next 10 years, I think you probably see, you know, I don't want to make a guess on the size of the market cap because that would just be erroneous. But if we see, you know, a trillion people a year, I can just the entire level of scarcity that was built in is going to just people are going to be able to see the difference between a currency, fiat currency, and a scarce currency, a scarce digital currency before them, and they're going to wonder why all their friends have all these nice things and they're still just barely getting by or whatever, you know.
That's kind of the subtle evil with inflation, and that is that it is very slow. Yeah. If you're in 1913 and you're jumping to 1918, well, your money hasn't lost that much value. Maybe so little that you wouldn't even really care. You're like, all right, you know, I lost 2 cents, you know, big deal. Like, you know, I can't do anything with 2 cents anyway. But the point is, when people will only save money for a reason. If that money is going to retain its value, no one's going to save. People would rather spend $10 now. If tomorrow it's going to be worth $1, you're going to maximize that $10 of value right now. So that's kind of the idea. And Keynesian economics pretty much promotes that. Say you have food in your fridge and you needed that to last a week, just go eat it tomorrow, because we're predicting that the food's going to be spoiled in 2 days. You know, just that's kind of a decent analogy, but it disincentivizes saving for a lot of reasons. But just the main reason, like we said, is people aren't going to save if there's nothing to really save for in the future.
Yeah, exactly. We live in I'm obviously an Austrian theorist too, as you are, but we live in a culture where it does encourage people. If you watch television, it's buy, 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 and there is no like education anymore.
The whole idea is that, you know, it's demand that supplies everything. So the only reason you have a job is because someone out there wants the good. Well, it could be backwards. It could be you're providing a good or service to someone that they didn't know about, that they're finding out about for the first time, like Bitcoin. People had to find out about Bitcoin for the first time. No one was demanding Bitcoin in 2005. Like, no one even had thought about it. It was really like an ingenious idea that took off. So, man, obviously I can really get right about this.
They're giving people incentive to spend in contrast to save. And that has a major effect on the entire economy. You see less production, less innovation, and obviously with that, the division of labor, medicine becomes worse. Everything becomes worse. You know, it kind of destroys a society.
Exactly. Well, let's kind of wrap up here. So we're going to talk about some of your favorite coins. We're going to talk about dApps, whatever that means. But first, let's talk about scams versus good coins. Now, you talk a little bit about ICOs, but in general, what would you suggest for people who are just getting into this stuff? What to look for and what to not do?
Firstly, I would not get into any ICOs personally. I think the
what is an ICO, by the way?
Initial coin offering. It's like a way for people to raise money now in the space. Didn't really exist in the early days, but it kind of evolved like all things in the market do, and it's a way for people to raise money for their projects. And normally an ICO has a white paper with it. If it doesn't have a white paper, that's the first sign that you shouldn't be getting into that project. That's number one. Read the white paper. And if you see a lot of mistakes and you see things that just red flags would be to me. Infinite scarcity basically would be one. I don't like any coin that hasn't inflated, doesn't have a cap. So finite supply is important to me. I would look at the developers, the team, just vet the people. It takes time. It's like anything else, though. You don't want to just throw your money into garbage, you know?
Yeah, I guess taking all things into consideration, you probably wouldn't want to get into a coin that has like 50 trillion of the coin. That would take a really long time to like make your money back on that and make any money at all. But yeah, so those are some really good points. What are your favorite coins?
I've always been kind of a Litecoin warrior. I like Charlie Lee from the beginning. He basically launched, I think, in 2012 or 2011. That's like right when I got in. So
didn't Charlie Lee sell all his Litecoin?
Yeah, Charlie Lee did sell all of his Litecoin, or at least
he said he did.
The vast stake in his holding. I believe Charlie Lee. I take him for his word. It's funny that people pick and choose kind of like what they want to remember about Charlie Lee. Like the months leading up to ATH, the all-time highs, he was kind of warning people, you know, like, this, we've seen this before, you know, this could be leading to more capitulation and then a long bear market again, and nobody wanted to listen to Charlie Lee, so I don't really blame him for getting out on top, but, you know, I think it was sort of, he had to do it, I think, because with tweeting out and stuff, he's like the CEO of a company. I don't know. It just seems like there's conflict of interest for him to hold and continue.
I guess from an optimistic point of view, he's giving that supply back to the community, so they can now.
Yeah, that's kind of.
He's probably already made his money. You know, maybe that's kind of the point. But people overlook trying to trash him.
In the beginning, this was like a lot of anarcho-capitalists too, so I don't really understand why anybody would be mad about him like selling his coins. He's not like bowing out of the project completely or anything. He's still like the captain of the ship. So if anything, I think I have this feeling Charlie Lee is going to work as hard as he can to make sure that they at least surpass the previous all-time high.
You know, one part about crypto, it's undeniably true. There's a lot of emotional aspects to this. Yeah. So from people on the outside looking in, it might look like, oh, he's selling all his coins because it's a crap coin. Like, why else would he sell his coins? But on the other hand, it's like, well, he's giving that supply back to the community. He's made his money. Those are some good points. Now, I think you mentioned Bitcoin. I think you mentioned Neo and Steam. Tell us about those.
Yeah, Steam and Steam. That's probably I'm most interested in that right now, I think. Dan Larimer, who created EOS, and he was in on BitShares as well. He's been involved in a lot of stuff. But he helped create the Steam blockchain, and it has like, I don't even know how many apps now, man, hundreds of apps, dApps on there, which are decentralized applications. And you can post your vlogs or blogs, curate content on there, and actually gain reward, monetary reward, through Steam-backed dollars is what the cryptocurrency is on there. And Steam, it's a very intricate process. It would take a couple shows just to explain Steam. It's very, very integral, but it's one of the most promising things, because I'm seeing people on there already in like very impoverished countries posting about their life and their families' lives and things like that, and they're gaining a lot of money. They're making a lot of money already on there. So I think this is like one of the things I was talking about in the book as well, is that we're going to see these blockchains really start to help the areas of the world that need it the most. Bitcoin, a lot of people, a lot of my friends personally aren't into Bitcoin yet because they don't need to be. But if you are using a currency which is like being totally destroyed and has constant, a fiat currency, a national currency that's constantly being debased, a blockchain like Steam could really change your life.
There has been times where crypto's literally saved my butt. I've had no food in the fridge. All my money is in crypto at that point. And I was able to figure out how to get like a Domino's gift card out of my crypto I had. You know, it just totally saved my butt sometimes. There's been times where I really, really needed money like right that second. I was able to hit up somebody at local Bitcoins, or, you know, I have a favorite guy that I go to. I was able to have that money within an hour or two. Just really, it really did save my butt. I would say, you know, whether you're holding gold or silver or Bitcoin, you know, you do it for a purpose. You do it like all the reasons we've been talking about that. Gold and silver retain their value, and Bitcoin's probably, you're probably going to gain a lot of value from whatever you invest in. Now, obviously, the crash in November and December really, really hurt a lot of people. I think that's, that in general has been one of the reasons that, you know, we just haven't seen the market cap. The market cap is doing well for a while, but it just kind of like died out again. Like, I don't know what the reason is, but I think looking forward, I think a lot more projects are going to be started to be unveiled. I know my friend Michael Heiss, who works with the Mises Caucus, he's working on setting up a blockchain committee, and they may already have that committee set up, but he was talking about that. So there's a lot of things happening at once, and I think there was a small portion of time where Bitcoin did seem to be going mainstream, you know, namely like, you know, last October, November, December, like a lot of people were talking about it, but I don't know, the hype just kind of died out for a while, and I personally haven't been investing yet, but I think at some point it will start to go back up. It's just the government's done so much to try to stop all this, whether it's been China trying to ban miners or any of the regulations trying to be set up. There's obviously coins like Ripple that are problems in themselves, but maybe talk about Ripple real quick if you could.
Yeah, that was another incentive to get into this book, is when I saw a lot of people, like you're talking about our friends and stuff, getting in, and then I see them like getting into this most centralized projects, that, you know, where I'm like CNBC,
you're missing the point, guys.
I'm like, all right, you know, yeah, I'm trying to, you know, give them an economics lesson that's taken me like 7 years to really try to wrap my head around. I mean, the premise of the Austrian school is pretty simple, you know, just stay out of the way. But and the market, you know, works.
Don't artificially set interest rates.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If you're going to do it, set them higher so it encourages people to save. But I think that seeing people get into the centralized projects was a major – I think all that money is basically just wasted, because those coins aren't – there's the people that really are in cryptocurrency don't want to transact with those.
I guess that was kind of like my main point I was trying to get at, is that – a lot of people have watched others like put a mortgage on their house and like, you know, sell everything they have and put it in the crypto at 20K.
Yeah.
You know, plenty of people watch their friends lose everything, because if you're a noob now, if you bought at 20K and you haven't sold yet, you're not in the worst spot. I mean, you're in a bad spot. You've lost, you know, over 100% of your value, but if you haven't sold yet, you haven't lost yet. You only lose when you sell. So a lot of people did probably sell right away, like they bought in at 20K and sold at 10K, God forbid. But that did happen, and people, I think, are scared to get back in. I mean, it's a total gamble when the crypto market will start to rise again and get back to, like, you know, the 500-600 billion market cap. But
I have a theory that this being suppressed, you know, I think people will be bailing there. They'll be running back in here pretty soon to get in. And another thing that slowed it down was, once we were at like peak, peak adoption there for what we've been, at least, you know, what we've seen, it was like the peak. And a lot of the credit cards and banks stopped working with the people that were trying to buy crypto, which, yes, I don't know, maybe that is a good thing.
I have a Coinbase account, and at some point Capital One said, you know, you can't buy crypto through it. You know, I don't know if they said like you get in trouble if you try, but they were just like, you know, don't do it.
So, yeah, they were shutting people's accounts down, and that slowed it down a little bit too. Oh, but geez. I do think that it's being a little bit slow. It's being artificially held down. I think the people that, you know, there's a lot of big money coming in now. That's just my theory. Yeah.
Well, the book's titled Blockchain Project Renaissance. I'm here today with R.L. Breyer. Tell us where we can get the book. I think you're charging some Litecoin for the book, if you mentioned.
Yeah, I pinned the price in Litecoin, 0.2 Litecoin. And you can just email me for the book right now at PittsburghHodler.com, PittsburghHodler, or at gmail.com. And email me if you're interested in a copy. I'll send it right over to you and provide you with my LTC public key, as we were talking about there a little bit ago. But yeah, I got a picture here of the...
Send me your private key if you could. I don't need that
book. The cover. My friend in Germany actually did the cover. I wanted to shout him out. So he's another... this is another example of the crypto space, I guess.
Yeah.
friend over in Germany. I'm meeting people all over the world through cryptocurrency. It's amazing. Yeah. And now him and I are working on a magazine too, so I wanted to mention that.
That's great, man.
Online magazine, yeah.
That's great. Well, let's do this again sometime. I'm always down to talk crypto with people. Sadly, I don't have that many friends anymore that are even in crypto. Like, a lot of them just bailed or don't talk about it anymore. Obviously, most 9 out of 10 people you go and talk to in public, they may have heard of Bitcoin. I'll just give you one last story to wrap up here. There was this one situation where I owed a guy like $200. And I was just like, dude, I don't have the cash on hand. I didn't really feel like selling it right now. I'll give you $300 worth of Bitcoin. He wouldn't do it. Was kind of mad. I asked. Was just like, you know, I don't know how to use that. Like, I was just like, dude, I can show you how to do the app. Like, I can show you how to sell it. Just no interest at all. No interest at all. Like, I don't know how to use it. I don't want to learn how to try. That's the mindset a lot of people were in. They're too comfortable with the system we have now. And in that, they don't see how screwed up everything is. They think this is all how it's supposed to be. So, you know, that's, I try to get more people in crypto if I can, but I understand that a lot of people just personally have no interest in it at all. But people like me and you obviously are looking up towards the future.
Yeah, that's great, man. I'm glad you did that, because I'm the same way. I go, like, I'm the guy going through the checkout line like, hey, have you heard about, you know, Bitcoin yet? Like, trying to get them to implement it into their program or with their store or whatever. So
yeah,
I'm like throwing those little hints into my friends and people that I see all the time too.
I'm in Denver, and I was in a dispensary the other day, and they're accepting Bitcoin now. Or actually, I don't think it's Bitcoin. I think it's like some cryptocurrency related to what they want to sell. Like, it's not any of the main coins. So I was just like, wow, you know, to see that in a dispensary out of all places, that's pretty huge. I mean, just to see it anywhere is huge. I personally think the one thing about Bitcoin that is lacking right now, it has many of the features of what we consider money by Rothbardian standards, except the universality that, you know, I can't really take Bitcoin and spend it on Amazon unless I do purse.io. I can't take it in like a grocery store and spend it unless the grocery store happens to accept it. Just in general, like, it's not, you can't use it universally right now. It's the only thing that I think that's holding it back from being a money. I definitely think it's a currency. And I think Bob Murphy would agree with me that it's a currency, but whether it's a money, I think time will tell.
I haven't heard his take on it yet. I'd like to hear what he has to say. I've heard Tom Woods talk about it.
He has a book. It's you can look it up. It's understandingbitcoin.us. That's the site. Understandingbitcoin.us. And Bob Murphy co-authored it. I think he wrote it years ago. He may have updated it, but he gives a pretty interesting take. I think he takes on the is money a commodity thing himself. So it's all good debate. I think, you know, just people talking about it in general is huge.
Yeah, the people that want to innovate, it's great.
Yeah. All right, RL, it's been a great pleasure having you on, and I guess I'll see you next time.
Yeah, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it, Steve.